ho! Merry Christmas!
So a message to our listeners, wishing them a Merry Christmas for those of you that celebrate Christmas, for those of you that don't. It certainly is a festive season in Australia around this time of year. Lots of holidays, lots of get-togethers with families, and certainly there'll be more of that this year than there was last year as COVID is not as bad. So wishing you all the best, and just keep in mind that our podcast will still roll out as per normal over the holiday period.
Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos,
that's me,
and the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have your company again. This week, we're looking at purchasing laws in each different state and territory. Now, it's quite a lot we need to go through, so we might find that we have two episodes on this particular topic rather than just the one. But before we get stuck into it, let's have a quick chat to my two lovely co-hosts, Kate and Dave. Dave, how are you?
I'm going really well, Pete. The weather's getting warm. We're all sitting here in you and I are sitting here in T-shirt and shorts. Luke, my seven-year-old, played his first game of hardball cricket in the under-10s on the weekend and got a wicket with his first delivery. So,
This is easy. What are you people talking about? This game's easy. Yeah.
He didn't get a wicket for the rest of his two overs that they each get to bowl. But
Kate, how are you?
I'm good, Pete. Gab's on a school camp this week, so we've been going out. It's been the best. A lot of fun. I do miss it. But, yeah, it's been really cool having stuff on. It's not a common thing for me to be out Monday and Tuesday night and having a wine. And, yeah, it's been fantastic.
Well, it's wonderful that kids can go on school camps again, because I'm sure they've been put on hold for the last 18 months, because, you know, I reckon they're a very, very valuable component of their education to get out in the real world and see what really happens, whether it's, you know, based on biology or based on geology or geography or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it was a joy watching her prep for this. We had three shopping trips to constitute a three-day camp. She had the overseas big suitcase packed like she was spending a year away, and then still had more stuff to go. And I'm sure that the girls have all got lots and lots of different changes of fashionable stuff. And it was great seeing all the excitement, because it's, as you've said, been 2 years of no school camps, and it was a big deal for her.
Yeah. Our son, who started prep at, you know, and then COVID hit, he went on his first excursion 2 days ago, almost finishing grade one, to the Werribee Zoo. So it's just been such different times, hasn't it?
Yeah, fantastic that it's all opening up. That is absolutely wonderful. So, Kate, what's your market update?
Well, Pete, my market update is straight out of a CoreLogic report, and it's very quick, so I'm just going to read it. National dwelling values rose 22.2%, comprised of 25.2% lift across regional Australia and 21.3% rise in combined capital city dwelling values. I think that's incredible, really, for regions to be performing at that. This is over the rolling 12 months. In the same period, there were an estimated 614,635 dwelling sales across the country, which is the highest annual sales volume since December 2003. So for everyone out there who says there's no stock, there's been heaps of stock. It's just that we've purchased it, we've soaked it up really quickly.
Very true. Excellent update. Thank you for that, Kate. Dave, what's your market update?
My market update is, I'm just harking back to a recording we did which went live June 15. It was episode 105, where I made a bit of a prediction about what was going to happen with fixed rates and talked about how they were likely to go up and and the reasons why, which included the RBA's $188 billion facility to provide low-cost funding, 0.1% to the banks on three-year terms, was coming to an end. Bond yields were going up at the time because of the higher global inflation pressures. There were doubts the RBA would be able to keep rates on hold and doing its quantitative easing. So I just thought I'd look back at what had happened since then. So Commonwealth Bank's three-year and four-year fixed rates for owner-occupiers paying principal and interest have risen 80 to 85 basis points.
That's huge.
So from two, massive. Their three-year fixed rates risen by 90 basis points and on investment loans. ANZ's three-year owner-occupied principal and interest has risen by 95 basis points. Five-year owner-occupied has risen by 90 basis points. P&I, 3 years investment interest only, and 5 year investment interest only, 65 basis points. For our listeners who pay attention to our market updates, and I know you just spoke, Pete, how you beat the banks recently and locked in.
Yep. First time in about 30 years, yeah.
Yeah. So they certainly could have banked a fair bit of cash if they've locked in, and we've been, certainly with our clients, we've been getting them to rate, talking to them about rate locking with more of a focus than other times. We always cover it, but we've been really highlighting the importance of, we've had some great wins for our clients who have locked in but hadn't settled on their loans and rates had gone up between the lodgement date and settlement date. What's happened during that period is the three-year bond yield has increased significantly. The 10-year bond yield has actually stayed pretty similar, but that's 10 years, factoring in what rates will do over 10 years. And the bank bill swap rate, 3 years and 5 years, have also increased by around 90 to 100 points. So there's some of the other reasons why I thought they were going to move and why they have moved. So hopefully some of our listeners have taken advantage of those insights and saved themselves 75 to 90 basis points with some of the major banks at least.
So there's a good illustration of how the market might be affected. The Reserve Bank does not move cash rate one iota. Some banks moving at 90 basis points. For those people who aren't too good at finance, 90 basis points is almost one full percentage. So 100 basis points is one full percentage. So that is a significant move. So that means basically before the interest rate, maybe you could borrow money. After the interest rate, you can't borrow money. Or at the very least, it means you borrow less. So there'll be less pressure on property prices to increase at the same rate as there has
100%.
Been 100%. Yeah.
One other quick fact too is because fixed rates had been so low historically and lower than the variable rate, which we've talked about a number of times, the percentage of fixed rate loans in Australia during the last sort of year or so had jumped to 40 to 50% share of all new mortgages, whereas generally it sits around 10 or 15%. Because of that fact, it's also having a bigger impact on the cost of lending for borrowers to get into the property market than probably ever before, because just, more people have been fixing.
It goes to show just, you know, how humans chose rate, because for that period of time that you've just alluded to, Dave, fixed rates were cheaper for a long time, cheaper than the variable rate. And some people would have stepped into fixed rates, not necessarily understanding the risk of taking on a fixed rate as well. And we've talked about that before. When you've got an economic break cost to factor in, you'll be very careful picking a fixed rate if you think an imminent sale is on the horizon.
Yeah, 100%. So there's a lot to factor in when you fix a loan, isn't there?
Yeah.
Certainly is. Well, thank you very much, you two. Fantastic property market update.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
We have an action-packed episode today. Lots of stuff to get through because we're trying to cover the six states and the two territories when it comes to all the different purchasing laws. So let's start with what constitutes a legally binding contract, and we'll talk to our contract expert. That'll be Kate. So how about you tell us about Victoria, Kate? When do you have a legally binding contract in Victoria?
When you've got a contract with both party signatures on it, and an exchange of contract is a term that you hear a lot, and different states treat the exchange slightly differently, but it's not enough just for the real estate agent to have the party sign it and then say, I'm holding a contract. It's then got to be given to each party. Once they've received a copy of their signed contracts, solicitors or conveyancers are included, but it's once the two parties have a copy, it's considered a deal.
Right, excellent. Dave, what about some of the other states and territories?
In New South Wales, ACT and Northern Territory, you often hear the term exchanged. So what that means is there's actually two, there's a different copy and they're signed by each of the parties, and then they are actually, the exchange happens and the solicitors swap the signed contracts. And only at this point of the exchange is the vendor legally bound to proceed with the sale. The key point probably across each of the states is you need to have a fully signed and executed contract before it is a legally binding purchase. And one of the reasons we're talking through this episode is to help people understand the little details and nuances across the different states and territories, because there's been plenty of times where people have thought they've purchased a property when they actually haven't. There's misunderstandings around what is a legally binding purchase, what are the different timeframes for cooling off periods, what is the subject to clauses. And so, yeah, we're going to work our way through that across each of the states and territories for our listeners today.
Right. Okay. So just to summarise, so what you're saying is New South Wales, ACT, the Northern Territory, there are actually two contracts, one signed by the vendor, one signed by the purchaser, and they're swapped over, they're exchanged. Whereas in the other states, each party signs the one contract.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. With Queensland, it has to actually be delivered to the buyer's solicitor. So that's a slight difference to Victoria, South Australia, Tassie and WA. But yeah, in essence, that's the key point of differentiation.
And right. Let's just define some of these terms. Solicitor or conveyancer is okay. There's no state that legislates you have to have a solicitor. You can have a conveyancer. And we've talked about the difference between them before. And these days, most contracts that I get people signing are electronic, probably above 90%. And COVID really pushed us along there. Anyone who was reluctant had to climb out of the dark ages and deal with modern technology. And so it's a lot easier to do these exchanges now because it comes to you as an email and it's flicked straight over to all parties, including legal reps. So it's really streamlined the process and, you know, changed it completely. And with the digital signatures and all of the platforms that we use, some agents use RealTime, we use DocuSign, you've got parcel IDs. It's all very, very clear when it was signed. And so it has removed some of those shades of grey.
That's great. So we've clarified that. So does that mean, though, that as soon as you sign the contract, you are committed to buy? Or do we have in real estate, like we have in other consumer law, cooling off periods?
We certainly do.
Great question, Pete. I think you know the answer to that.
I've got the answers right in front of me.
That's right. You've got the rundown.
But not everyone has a cooling off period. Not every state or territory has one, do they, Dave?
No, they don't. Western Australia and Tasmania, they're pretty unforgiving over there. No cooling off period in each of those states. And we'll come to subject two clauses after this. So, yeah, they don't allow a cooling off period. Once you've signed the dotted line, if you don't have any sort of subject two clauses, well, you're owning that property. Whereas the rest of the states and territories do. So South Australia, you have two clear business days. Victoria has three clear business days, Northern Territory four, Queensland five, ACT and New South Wales also have 5 days. And then there are actually penalties associated. So although you can pull out of the contract after executing the contract, both parties executing the contract, many of the states and territories will force the buyer to still pay a fee to the vendor, because obviously it's potentially cost the vendor, well, it's definitely cost them time, might have cost them some money, and also potentially another buyer.
It's the agents that enforce that. And if a deposit hasn't been collected, it's very, very hard to get the calling off penalty out of a buyer. So you'll often find that an agent at the very least will ask for a small part deposit that covers the calling off.
Let's state here, we do have the auction queen on the show. There is no calling off at auction, is there, Kate? Doesn't matter what state you're in.
No, there's no calling off, unless, as Dave has said, something was negotiated. But whenever a buyer mentions calling off to an agent at the point of signing a contract, it does send a shiver through the agent's spine, because if the buyer is thinking that they want to preserve their calling off, then there's always a concern there that they're not committed to the purchase. If you were going to auction and you desperately needed an out clause, then you could try and negotiate that. But in a hot market, you'd have a very, very slim chance. To that point, Pete, auctions in Victoria, we are considered to be participating under auction conditions when it's 3 business days either side of the auction date. So let's say the public auction date is on the Saturday. Then we know that as at 12 p.m. on Tuesday night, anything after that, so Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you're bidding under auction conditions, so you've got no calling off, even if you want to put in an offer prior, and then all the way until 11:59 on the following Wednesday.
All right, that's interesting. In South Australia, it's certainly leading up to the auction, but if the property passes in at auction and you're making offers, it's based under auction conditions just till midnight of that day. And then after that, then you can, negotiate terms.
Yeah, that's unique to Victoria, the auction capital, covering those 3 days either side. Most of the other states, it's only on the actual day. So you can actually, agree to a purchase up to midnight the night before, and it's not under auction conditions.
Right. So we're going to cover a lot of stuff today. We're not going to be able to say everything on our show, but Anne-Marie has got some fantastic notes, very comprehensive notes that you can have a look at. So just to summarise the cooling off period, every state and territory is different, ranging from 0 in Western Australia and Tasmania all the way to 10 days if you're buying off the plan in New South Wales. And some states have a penalty if you change your mind, that is you cool off, and there is no cooling off if you buy at auction. So 3 very key takeaways so far as cooling off is concerned.
I also want to bring to people's attention that there are some other exceptions to calling off. So it's not just auction in Victoria. If you are signing a contract as a company, so let's say you're a director, you're buying it in the business name, you're not entitled to a calling off. If the property is commercial or industrial, no calling off. If you've entered into a contract with someone and then exited it for whatever reason and then had another crack at it, on that second crack, there's no calling off. And if you're a licensed real estate agent, there's no calling off.
Right.
So great little tidbits there, Kate. Got to read the fine print, don't you?
You do. Yes. The fine print's not that fine. It's in highlight on the front page. So if you're not familiar, have a look. The number of times I've heard people suggesting that they can get out of a contract and they've signed it in a company name, it can't happen.
Right.
So just another one too. In New South Wales, you actually are able to waive your right to the calling off period as a negotiation tactic. As well, as Kate talked about, if you're talking about the calling off period with the agent, it's going to make them nervous about how serious you are.
Not a good sign. No.
So, you actually can waive that in New South Wales to help with solidifying the negotiation.
We do that in South Australia as well, but you have to do that in front of a solicitor.
Yeah, in Victoria, we used to be able to have a solicitor review the contract instead of a conveyancer, and that would enable the buyer to say, I'm not entitled to a calling off period now because I've had a solicitor review the contract. And they changed that law back in about 2011. And so now a buyer is entitled to a legal review and legal advice, and they don't waive their right.
Very good. Okay, so let's move on to some common subject to clauses. Remember, auction, and in some other instances, there is no subject to. But if you're buying by private treaty, which is negotiation basically, then you can put in some clauses. So, Dave, what are some of the common clauses that people put in their contracts?
Some of the most common ones are subject to obtaining finance is probably the most regular. Building and pest inspection. Also, although in Tasmania, apparently they don't have termites, so it's just the building inspection. Contract review by the purchaser's solicitor or conveyancer. They're probably the 3 main ones. Occasionally you might have something to do with some form of maintenance. on the property you might have, and it's not that common in Victoria, but it can be more common in some other states, subject to the purchaser selling their existing property. Not that it doesn't occur in Victoria. There are many others, but they're five of the more common subject to clauses that you can have in a contract.
So, Kate, when they have subject to obtaining finance, in the Victorian contracts, what do they specify? Do they specify how much, the interest rate, who you can get it from? What do they specify there?
It's got three things: how much you're borrowing, where you're borrowing it from, and how long you need to sort it out.
Right. Okay.
Now, sometimes if I've got a purchaser who is wanting a property and the negotiating has been fierce and the price that they need to pay to secure the property is a price that they're uncomfortable with, in other words, we're struggling to have a plan B if there's a valuation shortfall, and we're concerned that the risk of valuation shortfall is higher because of the price that they need to pay to beat the competition. Sometimes I will have a subject to satisfactory bank valuation or subject to the bank valuation meeting the contract price. And I'll say to an agent, I know you don't like this, but it's a very, very good price. Your vendor would have to understand that. So we're prepared to pay it as long as the bank agrees with the price tag that we're paying. And sometimes that'll get across the line. It's not something I like doing, and nobody wants to pay a premium, but sometimes it's relevant if there are limited comparable sales to support the purchase price. It doesn't mean that they're paying too much. It means that a valuer might be scratching their head as well. So it just depends on what sort of risk the person is facing, whether they've got other lending options or whether they're already at a high LVR and this is the only lender they can go with. I will need to step in with something quite protective.
Right. So I found it interesting that I understand that, you know, all states allow for subject to clauses in their real estate contracts. But in New South Wales and the ACT, it's not that common. But how do people go with borrowing money to buy a house in Sydney if they can't say, look, I'll buy it, providing I can borrow the money? So they have to be pre-approved. That must be solid. Is that right, Dave?
Well,
they moved to the Gold Coast, Pete.
It's why, which we're going to come to, gazumping. It's why gazumping is more common in New South Wales and ACT, because they don't put those subject to clauses in there. And so there really is that risky period in between agreeing to the purchase and actually exchanging and swapping the contracts. And so, you know, often what people might try and exchange and then get the contracts in, they have the 5 business days, so they have a bit longer in terms of the cooling off period in New South Wales. So they'll try to make sure they've sorted out some of those aspects within those 5 days. But it is why gazumping is more of a concern for buyers in New South Wales, because they don't generally put those subject to clauses, don't put them in there.
So what is gazumping, Dave? It sounds like something you would do in the southern states of the US. What actually is gazumping?
it's an interesting word, isn't it? Gazumping occurs when an agent or seller accepts an offer you make to buy a property and at an agreed price, but the property is sold to someone else.
Well, so that's a bit rude, isn't it?
That's right. So the typical scenario is a buyer shakes hands with the vendor and their agent on a property deal. Obviously, they haven't signed and exchanged the contracts. And then the buyer starts carrying out their due diligence to ensure they can complete the deal. So, you know, that might be the building and pest inspection, the contract review, the finalisation of the evaluation or the finance. But before the contract is signed to formalise the deal, and obviously, say, for example, in New South Wales, it would need to be outside of the cooling off period, another buyer swoops in and with a higher offer and or better conditions. And in that case, you're out in the cold and you've been gazumped, Pete.
Hey, the moral of the story, though, is I hear this term all the time. If you haven't got a contract, you haven't got a deal.
Yeah.
And gazumping, it's a horrible thought, but if you're planning on signing a contract and for whatever reason you're not putting pen to paper, well, the likelihood of someone coming along and being prepared to do so in a hot market is pretty high.
Yeah. So your verbal offer is not worth the paper that it's not written on?
Absolutely not. And if you still need to get things done, pop them in the contractor's conditions. Don't muck around thinking that someone's giving you a handshake deal and that you can preserve putting pen to paper until you've satisfied your inquiries. It's a silly thing to do.
Yeah. So gazumping is allowed, even though it might seem unethical to some people, it's certainly legal because, as you said, you haven't signed a legally binding contract yet. I mean, you can't sign a legally binding contract for the property and then go and sell it to somebody else.
But do you know what I always say? Whenever I've got a client who's upset about something or I meet someone who's had a bad experience, and I just say to them, put yourself in the vendor's shoes for just a minute. And Pete, if you think about it, you've been a recent vendor. If you had someone floating around saying, yeah, I'll be signing it as soon as I've done X, Y, Z, probably next week, I'll come in on Saturday, and your agent's feeding you this, as a vendor, you'd be getting very nervous. And then you get someone who comes through, they like it, they're committed, they're organized, they sign a contract. You're going to take that contract.
Yeah. And also, just to differentiate with New South Wales and ACT in particular, and I think Northern Territory, you can have signed the contract and it can happen because you haven't exchanged. And you
That's right.
So just to delineate with the other states, obviously, yes, you must sign it. But in those states, you can sign it but not exchange.
And you need to be all over it with the exchange. You need to force that. When am I getting the exchange contract? When can I crack the champagne? I'm very, very clear with people about when it's a deal.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so it's a really good point, Kate. And also in New South Wales, what they'll sometimes do is negotiate a longer cooling off period too and agree on that, which in essence is like the subject to clauses. It just buys more time to finalise the finance and what have you and makes it less likely to get kazumped.
In Victoria, we call that request of an extension. So let's say you've asked for 14 days with your finance and then, surprise, surprise, the bank still hasn't assessed it and your broker's saying to you, oh, can you get an extension? That's when you notify your legal rep. You say to them, my finance still isn't through, it's not looking good, I don't think I'll have it today, can we please request another week? The other side has to agree to it. If they don't agree to it, then you've got a tough decision to make that day. But if they do agree to it, they write to each other and then it's formalised. You've now got a three-week finance clause.
Yeah, exactly. And so in an ideal world, you don't want to have to request an extension, do you, Kate? Because
I hate it.
Buyer's agents particularly hate it.
Oh, it's difficult because then I've got to lean on the agent to lean on their vendor to explain the context. Because if a vendor gets spooked and they don't have background information, they can think that you haven't got the capacity to buy the property. So you've got to make it really clear, you know, ANZ have put out this amazing offer and the queues have blown out and it's still in the assessment pile and the broker's really confident. Yeah, it's how you sell it.
Well, 100%. Often, you know, our strategic mortgage brokers or property planners will call the agent and have the conversation with them to say, look, you know, they're going to service, the loan's going to be approved, you know, they're in a really strong position. Talk through some of the specifics, you know, they could borrow a lot more. I'm oversimplifying the language here, but there's a lot of room to move in the loan-to-value ratio so you can have great confidence that this is going to be approved, but, yeah, there's just been a delay with the lender. But in an ideal world, you know, if you are negotiating an extended cooling-off period or subject to finance period, you're better to, if you can get it, err on the longer period to start with rather than having to go through an extension or even multiple extensions.
Which I don't know, Dave. Depends on what you're facing at the time of competition.
I guess it's not that black and white.
Well, if someone else has a shorter finance clause, you're better off hoping that you can get that extension across the line than missing the deal.
Yep. So get the deal, have the shorter period of time, even if you think you may not be able to get all your ducks in a row, but back yourself that possibly you'll be able to extend it because you've actually got it across the line with the shorter period, even if you can't get your ducks in a row within that period of time, which is obviously a risk for those people who are keeping it shorter, or that you just go ahead with it, even if you haven't got all your ducks 100% in a row. For example, you're not formally approved yet, but you're pretty confident you'll be approved because you already were pre-approved.
Yeah. So we're talking now settlement period, which is a great segue into our next section. But before I ask the classic question, Kate, in your time as a buyer's agent, what's the quickest settlement you have ever seen?
My own.
How long was that?
Remember a couple of episodes, last episode we were chatting about contrarian.
Yeah?
Yeah. I did 19 days over Christmas.
Jeez, including all those public holidays.
I was a very busy broker, yeah.
Oh, you were the broker. You organised your own loan.
Yeah.
Ah, you asked for a lot of favours. Yes, I did. Pulled in a lot of favours.
Okay. I did.
That's 19, not business days, that's 19 calendar days.
19 calendar days.
Less than
11 effective days, 11 active days to get it done. It was very scary.
All right, so typically, let's look at the average settlement period. What are we looking at in Victoria, Kate?
It's funny. We have basically in month batches, 30, 60, 90, 120 are the normal dates they call for. But the reality is, as long as you can do it, you can pick your date, and if the vendor agrees to it, that's what you're signing a contract for or bidding with as a bidding term. So you can really pick whatever you want. You've just got to make sure it's not over a weekend, and I prefer it's not on a Friday, just in case we're late to settle. We don't want 3 days of penalties.
Yeah, everyone seems to want to sell on a Friday so they can move in on the weekend. But if anything's delayed, then, you know, that stuffs it up.
Yeah, I prefer Thursday. Yeah. And to your question before, Pete, I have seen someone with a cash settlement settle in 7 days once. That was very, very fast. Probably too much pressure putting on yourself and your legal reps to do something that quick. So even if the bank's not involved, you've still got all of your legal forms to fill out, all your transfer of land and everything that needs to be sorted for settlement to occur and to go smoothly. So, yeah, even if you're a cash purchaser, I wouldn't advise something as short as that.
How many years ago was that quick settlement?
Well, only a few years ago.
Okay.
For a client that was good to go.
Dave, in your time as a mortgage broker, what's the fastest finance approval you've ever been able to get for your clients?
Well, mortgage broking and property advice, Pete, now since 1999, 22 years. Matt, I can't remember too many less than 30. There's maybe been the odd one here and there where someone's wanted to do it maybe in 21 days.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's been one or two in 2 weeks, perhaps, but generally the shortest period is 30 days.
And that's blown out as time has gone on, so the last 3 years compared to the other 20 or so years?
I think certainly since COVID hit, the turnaround times have blown out, and therefore the risks of, you know, settling within 30 days. It's probably more common now, 45 to 60, but 30 days is still very doable.
So it's important for people to speak to their mortgage broker, strategic mortgage broker, because if you're going to put in a condition of finance, you need to be realistic. You can't say, oh, I'm going to get finance within 7 days, if that is never going to happen. So you need to put in a realistic time frame. And people nowadays realise that things do take longer when it comes to getting your finance organised. I mean, COVID is one reason. And it also depends on the time of year. Like, you know, we're doing this episode in early December. Unlike Kate, who was able to do it in 19 days, but she was the mortgage broker on her own deal. You know, I was speaking to my bank manager yesterday, and he said most of the business banking staff are going to go on holidays very soon. They'll go to skeleton staff. So, you know, try and get work done from mid-December. It's going to be almost impossible. So,
really clear about when your solicitor's office is closed.
Yep.
Because I lost a week, not just because of bank public holidays, the solicitor's office was closed. No one was working on that file.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other one too is self-managed super fund loans. They're a lot more complex. And so I'd recommend probably 90 days.
I won't do anything less.
With self-managed super fund loans.
Yeah. Absolutely. By the time all the bear trusts are sorted and all of the processes and steps have been followed, it's easy to clock up. 90 days. Now, something about subject to clauses, and we touched on this just a moment ago. If you've got a subject to clause and you've not put any activity or any effort into it, you can't then ask for an extension or ask to be let out of the contract without demonstrating that you've had a go at it. So, for example, if you've got a finance clause and you haven't sought any kind of assistance with getting your loan, and then you reach your 2 weeks and you say you want to walk away because you haven't got finance, the other side's solicitor or conveyancer can ask for proof of effort. If you haven't applied for a loan and done anything, they can actually enforce the contract.
Yeah, it's really important, isn't it, Kate?
Yeah.
If you're putting down subject to finance clauses, always have your solicitor look over them and probably design them. And you actually need to be able to prove that you weren't able to achieve or meet whatever those clauses were to pull out of the contract.
Yeah, sometimes they'll ask for a decline letter.
Well, look, we covered a lot, and we're not going to cover everything that we wanted to cover. So that'll be for part two. So in part two, we're going to look at underquoting laws. And I know a lot of agents are being accused of that at the moment. And, I mean, to come to their defence, it is very hard to work out a market value, an appraisal for a property when the market is moving so quickly. You know, even, you know, when I'm doing some valuations and I look at market comparisons and you go to the auction and it sells for much, much more. Well, you can't blame the real estate agent for that. It's just, you know, FOMO, interstate buyers, whatever the reason is. So we're going to cover underquoting laws and we're going to look at auctions versus private treaty sales. There are also other ways to sell property. Tender's another one. Expressions of interest is another one. So we'll look at all of those. But please don't leave us yet because we've got our gold nuggets from Dave and Kate.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
So, Kate, what's your gold nugget?
Is for people who are contemplating having all of these layers of protection when they're signing a contract, be really clear about the things that you're genuinely worried about and be clear about the things that aren't a huge issue or that you're feeling confident about, for example, your finance. Because if you're looking at totally protecting yourself and preserving all of your rights, you might water down the power of your offer and you could find that you either lose it to someone else or you're forced to pay more because the vendor is associating all of your conditions with a high-risk buyer. So if you're not really in a high-risk situation, don't add all of these special conditions and subject to clauses just to feel that you can sleep well at night when it might completely disadvantage you.
Excellent tip. Thanks for that, Kate. Dave?
Just along similar lines, you know, in a fast-moving market, putting down subject to clauses might cost you the property. And just keep in mind, if you're buying at auction, you're buying unconditional. So you're buying without the opportunity to put any of those subject to clauses in place. So as Kate said, think through, do you really need them? Can you have got your ducks in a row prior enough to be able to put in an unconditional offer as you're right from the start?
Excellent tip. So some great takeaways there from our two lovely I'm the bloody host.
This is great. You're on fire today,
Pete.
We're
your co-host, Pete.
It's been a big year, mate. I've spoken to so many people and, you know, we haven't worked as hard. I mean, in the education industry, a lot of it's because it's online. So there's extra working online or working from home, you know, or dealing with people that are working from home because everything's not home. Anyway, I'm just so thankful that the end of the year is fast approaching and we're all going to have a very well-deserved break. Let's just fingers crossed. All the borders stay open so we can enjoy some wonderful time with our family and friends.
Nice. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And just a quick shout out to Melinda Jennison, Veronica Morgan and Sam Spilsbury, who provided some great intel for their respective states for this episode.
Yes, nice. Excellent. Thank you to those three. And we look forward to having you with us again for part two of the different purchasing laws in every state and territory. So bye for now.
See you next week.
If you'd like to learn more about how to navigate a successful purchase, listen to episodes 20, Bidding Tactics 101, episode 29, Congenial Negotiation Tactics and How to Apply Them in the Right Situation, episode 73, Preparing for Auction, part 1, Appraising, Budget Setting, Due Diligence, Reserves, Lowball Offers and Auction Twists, episode 77, Setting Yourself Up to Purchase with Confidence and Why Getting Your Pre-Approval in Place is More Critical Than Ever. And also episode 98, Preparing for Auction Part 2, Cooling Off Period, Finance Approval, Negotiating Terms and Auction Quote Ranges.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.